She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative place where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our sponsor of this show and a great partner of Mrs. Green's World, the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability and makers of nationally award-winning organic compost. They are going national, and we are proud to have them as one of our partners and supporters. To learn more about them and their commitment to a healthy planet, please visit them at thefairfaxcompanies.com. Very, very exciting show today that is a great follow-up to a podcast we released last week with Olena Alec from the Climate Reality Project, sharing with you information about Al Gore's incredibly robust training of climate leaders and his passionate commitment to mitigating climate change. Please join me in welcoming our guests for this next hour, who also have a very powerful, exciting, and timely message to share with us, and who spent a great deal of time with former Vice President Al Gore. John Schenck and Bonnie Cohen are directors of the soon-to-be-released film An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Just a decade after An Inconvenient Truth brought climate change into the heart of popular culture comes this powerful follow-up that shows just how close we are to a real energy revolution. The sequel is being released in theaters all over the country, with limited release in select cities on July 28th, and then opening in theaters everywhere on August 4th. And needless to say, this is an appeal, a call, an inspirational request for all of our listeners to make a date, bring somebody, plan a party, but just make sure that you see the movie so that you are on the cutting edge of knowing what's happening to our planet. I'd like to take a little bit of extra time to share with you about John and Bonnie. John has directed and photographed many award-winning films. In 2016, he co-directed and photographed the Peabody Award-winning film Audrey and Daisy, which premiered in competition at the 2016 Film Festival at Sundance and was picked up as a Netflix original film. That's always a good thing. In 2011, John directed The Island President, winner of the Toronto International Film Festival's People's Choice Award and IDA's Paré Lorenz Award. John was awarded the 2004 Independent Spirit Award for directing Lost Boys of Sudan. Schenck was also the director of photography for the 2008 Academy Award-winning Smile, Pinky, and he won an Emmy for Blame Somebody Else in 2007. Now about Bonnie, she also has produced and directed an array of award-winning films. In 2016, Bonnie co-directed the Peabody Award-winning film Audrey and Daisy, which, as I said earlier, premiered at the competition in Sundance in 2016 and was picked up as a Netflix original. In addition to her directing work, Bonnie has served as producer on The Island President. Her work as producer and director on The Rape of Europa earned her a PGA and WGA nomination and was shortlisted for the Oscars. In addition, Bonnie produced John Else's Sundance film, Wonders Are Many, and together with, I think his name is Else, co-directed Inside Guantanamo, which was nominated for an Emmy for Best Documentary in 2009. Bonnie also produced 3.5 Minutes and Art and Craft. Both films were selected for the Oscar shortlist in 2015. Together with Lisa Shanoff, Bonnie is the co-founder of the Catapult Film Fund. And also a personal observation for me, for the past 20 years, this couple have taken on challenging and important issues, producing amazing and impactful films and making a difference. Again, it's a pleasure to have you both here.
No, we're thrilled to be here. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, I have a lot of questions, and I'm going to start by just a comment that I did a lot of research on the two of you and am publicly inviting you to do another show with Mrs. Green's World down the road starting with the, you know, you met at graduate school in, at Stanford, and I read a lot about some of the other powerful documentaries that you have produced, and I think it's definitely calls for another interview about other work, important work you're doing. So can we make that happen somewhere down the road when things calm down?
Sure, yes. Well, let's see how you feel about us at the end of the hour.
But. Yeah, and vice versa. So we'll see if we both pass the test. So I think one of the most obvious questions to start with, you just have to ask the obvious, why a sequel? How did it come about? Who wanted to make it? I mean, the multiple question of why did you and the powers that be believe it was important enough to film a sequel?
It's a great question. We actually came to this on request from Participant Media, who made the first film, and that whole first team, beginning with Jeff Skoll, who runs Participant Media, and Diane Wireman, who runs the documentary unit there, along with the whole team from An Inconvenient Truth, Davis Guggenheim, who directed it, and all the producers that worked with him, they all have been talking for a number of years about whether a sequel would be useful and worthwhile, and finally decided that with all of the new solutions that are in place to combat the climate crisis and the alternative energy revolution, it was time to look at what those solutions are, how quickly we're moving towards them, and kind of, you know, have a similar kind of wake-up call about the alternative energy movement as the first film did with the climate crisis. So we got the call from Participant to make this film. We'd worked in the climate space before with our film, The Island President. We had a long-term relationship with Participant Media, and I think they thought of us for a number of reasons, but we were thrilled to get the call.
Well, I'm telling you, it just it's so funny to say this, but it just begs another interview, and I say that sincerely because I was reading the trailers and going down the rabbit hole of lots of the other films you've done. So moving right along and trying to stay on track is Truth to Power. There's lots in that title, and people ask me, what does that mean? What is the origin of that phrase, and how does it apply to this film? And I read a lot about it. Does it really come from the Quakers, or what is the truth about Truth to Power, the second part of the title of the movie?
Yeah, we liked the double, triple, quadruple meaning of the phrase Truth to Power.
Yes, thank you, John.
So that you're not alone. We really felt like, of course, the Quaker origin of it is great, and people can get on Wikipedia and get a little history lesson, and there's a lot of amazing history about where that came from. For us, really, in the film, you see Al Gore kind of on the stump, so to speak, giving these amazing speeches, to a variety of groups, and one thing that's just kind of amazing about him these days is just he was always a good politician. He's kind of just at his best when he's speaking at the climate and how personal it is for him. He connects the climate crisis and the solution to it and the activism around it to all great social movements that have advanced humankind. You know, recently the fight for gay rights, going back in history, the fight for civil rights for African Americans in this country. Of course, the fight against apartheid, the women's suffrage movement. And those all had one thing in common, which is that, of course, the powers that be during those periods all said, no, you know, this is not going to change. This is not going to happen. And speaking truth to people in power was always an important piece of nonviolent social action that occurred around those movements and that ultimately led to us creating a better world for ourselves. So that's really kind of the key history that made it powerful for us as a title for this film.
And the truth is that the truth really still does matter to millions of us. In spite of what the news says, the traditional news, the truth really does matter to millions and millions of us. So I love the title, maybe now more than I even thought about 6 or 7 months ago. So kudos for that. So let's talk about the role of documentary filmmakers. They're meant to be dramatic and powerful and about things going on right here and right now. Given the things that changed from when the film was ostensibly complete, were you able to shape this film to include some of the drama that is going on right now, incorporating who is in the White House and the policies, not around climate change, the policies around climate change are basically being, eliminated. How did you do it without knowing the outcome of the election? Is that a three-part question or four-part? But I think
well,
you get it. Like, how did you do it?
We released, you're right, we had to finish the film. We did finish the film in time to premiere it opening night at Sundance.
Right.
The date of opening night of Sundance was the night before Trump's inauguration. We actually also showed the film to a packed house of about 1,200 or 1,300 people in Park City as the inauguration was going on that Friday morning, which was quite an emotional time for everyone. We did think long and hard about how to now look at the film and think about the film and potentially change the film in response to Trump, just the mere fact of him as president, and then specifically around his pullout of Paris, which has happened much more recently. And we have changed things at the very end of the film to incorporate that news. And, you know, we had this experience of, you know, finishing and then watching the film right before November, right before the election. And, you know, it was very powerful, of course, and what the work that Vice President Gore does in the film is powerful no matter what time or what is going on, what the political climate is. But then watching the film just after the election and the appointments that Trump was making to the most important cabinet positions around energy and the environment, which, of course, was devastating. It was all of a sudden a completely new lens with which to look at the film. We really feel like the substance of this film really just holds. We're looking at the kind of a year in the life of this one man who himself has had a very difficult and trying time, you know, of course, around the 2000 election, and rose back up after that to do this incredible and important work. More important work for all of us than had he been president, and we feel that work and the drama of the film really holds, regardless of who is president. But you know, the news was devastating, and we really feel like, and we know that Al Gore feels this way, that if our leadership is not going to do this work, then the American people will.
Yes,
and
yes.
that's already happening.
Yes.
You know, on the local and state levels, where, you know, mayors and governors and cities around this country have taken up the charge, and great work is being done.
And, you know, even with what I do every day, which is to create a global community of people who care about the planet, this has activated my matrix in ways that I was not doing. We met last week with the mayor to do the proclamation supporting the Paris Agreement. I have a meeting tonight with our climate reality leaders that have been to the trainings, and we're planning, you know, a big deal premiere for the movie with a panel of
Fantastic.
Scientists. So it has ignited a lot of passion. So I have another two-part question, but I think I can do it in two parts, actually. John, I was at the climate reality training in Denver where you spoke, and I was so blown away by the things you said. My show producer reminded me that when I came back to debrief and talk about possible guests, I put 5 stars next to your name. So I want you to know that, because because your passion was so clear, and you had such clarity about the importance of this movie. Do you remember any of those pearls of wisdom that you shared with us? Because you were, and I really did that I could send you a photo snapshot of the 5 stars. I said, we have to get this man on the show. What made you so incredibly passionate?
Well, I don't remember exactly what I said, but I certainly appreciate the compliment. You know, we, I sounded passionate because I am. Bonnie and I have spent our lives, telling nonfiction stories, often about really inspiring people, sometimes inspiring leaders such as Al Gore. And we kind of have this dual role, you know, sort of one part artist, filmmaker, storyteller, you know, really trying to kind of just get at the heart of what drives a central character towards a goal, which, you know, any film or screenplay or book or piece of theater should do. And then, of course, we have this other piece of us, which is that we're environmentalists. We feel strongly. We have about the state of our world. We have children who are teenagers who are going to grow up to live in the world that we leave them. And I think like a lot of people in this country are really have just kind of woken up and see this as the most important issue of our time. And so Al's story combined with the most important issue of our film, the ticking time bomb quality to where we are in terms of just how devastating the environmental news is. It's, you know, this film has a lot of hope in it. It's true that it does lay out this incredible hope of the sustainable energy revolution. But on the other hand, it has a lot of devastating news about where we are environmentally. You know, as a world, we continue to pour tons of greenhouse gases into the world every day, using the atmosphere, as Al Gore says in the film, as an open sewer for our civilization. And so we really did feel like we had to capture that. And Al Gore is such a singular person. He embodies this kind of metaphor of somebody who's fallen hard, you know, when he lost the presidency, but picked himself up with this optimism and hope and created a new kind of career for himself that in some ways arguably is more important than his first career. And that's inspiring. You'd see that in the film, that he goes about this work with just incredible passion, as you know from being at the Denver training. He's funny. He's warm. He's personable. We had a good time following him around and kind of sort of piecing the story together. So that's where the passion comes from.
And I have to tell you that some of those things that you just said, like I went thinking, oh, you know, we'll get to see Al Gore introduce the panels and tell a little bit about what he's doing. And I was blown away by his presence and really being intentionally present, how he did a lot of the training himself, about his moderating the panels. And I was also blown away by the depth and breadth and scope of his knowledge. I cannot believe how much this man knows and how much he remembers. I mean, I'm 66 years old, and he remembered more in that 2 days than I might remember, period. He knew authors and dates and scientists and what their research was on. And
I mean, you should have seen us when we first went to Nashville to meet him for the first time in July of 2015, and he showed us the long version of the slideshow. I mean, it went on for the whole day. It went on for 8 hours. We took a lunch break. But he was able to just call up information and recall stories. I mean, you know from the film that he travels around, he talks to people, he's in a constant state of acquiring information.
And retaining it.
and retaining it, and then being able to deliver it back in a way that is meaningful to an audience.
And
I'm sure you've had this experience, but you know, like when you read an interesting article or a book or see a movie or something, and you pass it on to a few friends because you think they might be into it. And you know, very rarely, at least in my life, do I get a response. Occasionally I might see that person later and say, "Oh yeah, thank you for sending that."
Right.
You do that with Al Gore. We have this experience. If you read an article or see something that's related to the environmental cause and pass it on to Al, within seconds, you get an email back. He's digested it. He has a take on it. He has this energy. He thanks us for it. He is so engaged in this. Is actually quite intimidating, because when you have a conversation with him, it's like talking to an encyclopedia. But it's combined with this warmth. You know, he did this 10-hour slideshow for Bonnie and me to give us kind of the lowdown on where things were when we first started the film. But he also kicked off his shoes, climbed up on the sofa, and pulled down the shade so we would have the perfect viewing angle of the TV that he was showing us on. He has this kind of human side to him, which is very warm, and you see it in the film that he's consoling people who were victims, survivors of the hurricane in Tacloban in the Philippines. So it's kind of an unusual combination of characteristics.
And a very different personality than I think people met when he was running for president. He's got nothing to lose at this point, and he's leaving a legacy of this incredible work he's been doing now for four decades in the environmental space. And, to us, it just, hopefully this comes out in the film, you have access to a man you thought you knew, but you're surprised by who he is.
I could not agree with you more, and I'm so jealous I can't even begin to articulate it. I couldn't even get close enough to get a selfie, and I promised everyone in Tucson that I would get a selfie with Al Gore, but people want to be near him. They literally want to be near him, and I talked to the president of the University of Arizona last night and talked to him about what it will take to bring the climate reality training here and all of the reasons why I think it'll work. So we're on a mission. And then I made the joke. I said to the new president, I said, and the only reason I really want to do it is I need to have a selfie with Al Gore. Of course, I'm kidding. But he is that powerful. He really is. He's a magnet. He's just got that personality that is so real. I know you won't believe this, but we have 1 minute till the first break, and I told you guys it would fly. But when we come back, this is the question I'd love you to think about. From everything that I saw and observed, from the films I've watched, from the clips of Al Gore, I cannot believe that he is still optimistic, and I want to know what feeds that optimism. For me, there are days when I want to go to the dark side and say there is no hope and go on a trip around the world, because what difference does it make to save for your retirement? But the feeling I get from him consistently is that he really is high on the optimism spectrum. So let's start with that question when we are back. And everybody, I know you will not want to miss a minute with John Shank and Bonnie Cohen. Stay here with me.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and SpeakUp networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks for listening and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. Joining me for this hour are John Shank and Bonnie Cohen, award-winning directors of the soon-to-be-released film and inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power, a 2017 American documentary film about former United States Vice President Al Gore's continuing and passionate mission to battle climate change. It is the sequel to the 2016 film, An Inconvenient Truth. The follow-up documentary addresses the progress made to tackle the problem and Gore's global efforts to persuade governmental leaders around the world to invest in renewable energy. And I want to tell you a little bit more about John and Bonnie, because it is so important that you know a little bit more about the guests that we have to spend this hour with us. John Shank is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and a founder of Actual Films in San Francisco. He recently produced and directed and photographed The Beginning, a cinema verite documentary about the making of Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, which I am going to be down that rabbit hole. Anyway, his films Dark Rooms and Naked to the World have aired on PBS and have won many awards. Since co-founding Actual Films in 1998, Bonnie Cohen has produced and directed an array of award-winning films, including The Island President, Inside Guantanamo, The Rape of Europa, and Wonders Are Many, and now both of them an Inconvenient Sequel. And just a personal observation for me, for the past 20 years, this couple have taken on challenging and important issues, producing amazing and impactful films, which I want to learn more about, and making a difference for our world. It's such a pleasure to have both of you here, and I'm sure you can tell that I mean that sincerely. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're in demand, and I got you. So we're really happy about that. So let's talk about Al Gore's optimism. How can he be optimistic? I have to ask that some days.
Well, you know, he's sort of a relentlessly optimistic person, period. He's a doer. He likes to move forward and move the needle whenever he can. And so his personality is such that he's chipping away every day at problems and trying to find solutions for them. In this case, of course, the climate crisis, the sort of ultimate existential crisis of our time, it's very easy to get depressed and paralyzed. And he often talks about how if you get too depressed, there can be paralysis and you can't move forward. And he helped us sort of come to terms with this and think about the kind of hope bucket that you need to constantly be filling. And you know, we sort of took a page out of his book, and every day we think about something that we can do to move forward and create change and positivity in our own lives as parents, as citizens of the United States, and as filmmakers. So, I remember a story from when we were in Greenland with him, which, you know, in terms of devastation, seeing a man who's dedicated four decades of his life to the climate crisis, standing in front of the melting, glaciers of Greenland was pretty tough stuff and very poignant and sad in a lot of ways. We were there with a couple of different scientists, and one of them, Eric Rigno, had recently published a report about the devastation in Antarctica. And, you know, Al was asking him about it and how to remain positive in the face of that kind of research. And Eric said to him, you know, it is tough and it is devastating, but, you know, it's sort of the equivalent of losing your pinky finger. Do you give up on the whole two hands as a result of that, or do you keep moving forward and figuring out how to work with what you have? You know, yes, it is terrible that we have done some damage to this planet that is irrevocable, but there is so much that we still can do if we just move it, if we move quickly to the solution. So, from our perspective, and this is true when we make documentaries all the time, we always are able to, we have the great fortune as storytellers to be able to see the world through the lens of all of these different kinds of perspectives. And in this case, the perspective and the breadth of knowledge of this man who, you know, not only his own experience, but he took us to places where we heard from other people that could inform us about how to stay positive. And the message is to just make sure to do something every day that for you personally moves the needle forward.
You know, I have fantasies about creating hashtags, which, you know, at 66, it's great that I'm still having fantasies. And it's things like, it's like, okay, hashtag hope bucket. Those things like that, Bonnie, are what help me doing this show and interviewing people like you that keep me going, because my message has to be about hope, possibility, and change, because I am one voice that people are listening to. So thank you for that. I wrote down hashtag hope bucket. So let's talk a little bit about the film itself. There were some glaring truths about the predictions that Vice President Gore made over 10 years ago, and many people scoffed at them or laughed or at least claimed them to be over-exaggerated. And a critical scene, or most criticized scene, I should say, was the one when he talked about sea level rise and storm surge that would storm the site, that would fill the site of the 9/11 memorial in New York. And then, of course, Hurricane Sandy hit, and this is tragically what happened. How did you address this in the movie, or did you address it in the movie? I have not seen the whole movie.
Well, the movie is really a combination of a behind-the-scenes drama where you see Al kind of gathering the material for his slideshow. So you see him go to Greenland. You see him go to Tacloban, where there was an incredible, the most devastating hurricane to ever make landfall a couple of years ago in the Philippines. And then you see him go to Paris, where he helps negotiate the Paris Accord, and it becomes like a kind of a high stakes political drama there. But it's more of a kind of behind the scenes tour film kind of vibe than just a slideshow presentation. So you get that kind of personal closeness to Al Gore, which is really important for our film. But in terms of the piece that you're talking about, we do dip in the film into actual slideshows where he's giving the slideshow to some trainees, say in Denver, Houston or in Miami or in Manila, the Philippines. And it's during a slideshow presentation that we filmed in Miami where he's talking about what you're talking about, which is that he kind of tells the trainees that about this. He reminds the trainees that he made this prediction. It's really not his prediction. It was the prediction of scientists at the time,
right,
that sea level could eventually rise in places like New York, and then tells the story of Sandy. Sandy is really a powerful kind of twofer kind of climate disaster story, because one thing that's going on is our oceans are heating up, and then hurricanes, which move over oceans at a higher temperature, gain more energy, so that when they do make landfall, they're more powerful and they're more devastating to the communities they hit. And then also, of course, sea level rise is higher, so when there is more devastation, there's more flooding. And so you see that kind of twofold effect in what happened to Sandy, and it did indeed flood the 9/11 memorial exactly where the scientists were predicting that it eventually would flood. The other thing is that you see in the film is this incredible scene in Miami. You know, at the highest tides now in Miami, Florida, there is a foot of water in the streets. And this is a state that has a governor that...
That's a climate denier.
...made global warming. Yeah. And so you know, Al has this great line, like, you know, how can the governor slosh around in these streets and say, I don't see any flooding. Do you see any flooding?
It's so not funny, but you have to laugh.
No, exactly.
It's bizarre.
Our element, yeah, it's kind of a gallows humor develops, because that's one way that our psychology deals with just kind of the calamity of it, the situation.
I know. And there's an octopus going down the street. I mean, I've actually seen clips of that, and that's normal. I mean, we always expect to see an octopus coming out of the sewer drains, but it's just, oh yeah, surprise, surprise. So you kind of addressed this, but if there's anything else either of you want to add, one of the major critiques of the original film was that it was visually simple. And for someone like me that has a mild form of ADD, it was a hard film for me to watch, and watch it I did, and watch it again, because it was so content rich. So how did you approach the filmmaking this time around? You talked a little bit about it, much more personal scenes with Al Gore, the human being. But what are some of the other changes that are different, and what can we expect for exciting highlights? I'm excited.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I should start off by saying that we really stand on the shoulders of the first film.
Yes.
It's an incredible
Academy Award winning first film.
And an Academy Award-winning first film. Davis Guggenheim just knocked it out of the park. It was a particular moment in time where, when that information came out, it was like a ripple effect around the world, and it did an incredible job of kind of sparking the movement. So, of course, we couldn't do that. Our job was to try and figure out a way to, and we try and do this with our films, is to, we had this incredible leading man that we needed to dig into and figure out how to make his emotion come across and the drama of his life come across. And, you know, you'll see some of our other films, we tend towards the cinema verite style. We let scenes unfold in front of the camera. We like to find inherent drama in everyday life. And in a way, it was a risk, because we didn't know what was going to happen in the life of Al Gore necessarily in that year that we were following him. But it turned out to be the year of our presidential election. So the campaigns were going on in the background of the film. He was kind of preparing for the climate conference in Paris, though he didn't know what the outcome was going to be. He ends up in Paris during the terrorist attacks, which was very dramatic and difficult. He ends up visiting the Philippines where Tacloban, the city of Tacloban in the Philippines had probably the most devastation, anywhere in the world from a superstorm. And he meets with climate refugees there and people that went through that, and then gives a training there to the people that went through it. So we really went with our gut. We kind of, there was some risk taking there, but we figured if we found, the man that we found so emotional and appealing and, capable of such, drama was sort of, living his life out in front of us and doing the work in front of us. We figured if we could capture that, in an organic and authentic way on camera, that would be the makings of great cinema. So we went with our gut. It was a risk, but hopefully you'll see the film and you'll tell us if it turned out.
Well, from what I've been reading, there's such excitement about it, and I mean it sincerely. Our team that's working to create excitement here we honestly can't wait. And I want to ask you, it's a little bit more on the personal side for both of you, but I think there are some race against time issues we are facing as a planet if we don't get more aggressive in addressing them. Are there any big things that stand out to you from having spent so much time with him and getting educated yourself on the big issues? I know we are, renewable energy sources really matters, but were there any big aha moments for both of you that said, I had no idea things were this bad and we really need to wake up about this particular thing? Or was it all just, we better be paying attention to everything?
Well, going back to that first time we met Al, we went to his house and had this 10-hour show. By lunchtime, we really were ready to slit our wrists. It was just like, it was so bad.
I'm so glad you said that. It's like, it's daunting.
It was. I really don't mean to make light of the people who have mental health issues, but it was really depressing. And this can cause kind of a level of despair that is really personally difficult for people. But I have to say, we went and we had lunch, we came back, and he kind of lifted us out of it, out of the depression, because there is so much hope. And, I think it's embodied by the reaction that we saw to Trump's announcement regarding the pullout of Paris. That was kind of a nauseating day to live through that, as somebody who cares about the environment. But on the other hand, the next day or even that night, you started to see climate change stories in mainstream media.
Yes.
CNN had 3 days worth of climate news, along with newspapers and television shows all around the country. You saw this political activism going on in ways that we haven't seen so passionately. Governors of states like California and Hawaii, mayors of cities declaring carbon neutrality. I love the mayor of Pittsburgh who stood up and said, hey, wait a minute. President Trump, you're talking about our city, but you're not really talking to us, the people who live in Pittsburgh. We care about the environment. We want to stay in the Paris Accord, and we're going to go carbon neutral. Atlanta, Georgia has announced the same thing. We have a great scene in the film where Al goes to Texas and talks to a conservative Republican mayor who has taken his city carbon neutral because it's the financially right thing to do, and he thinks as stewards of God's earth, it's the right thing to do. And so it's a mix. I mean, it's bad, like Bonnie was saying. It's depressing. But on the other hand, there's this incredible groundswell of reaction that is kind of like leading from the streets. That's really exciting.
And to just reflect on that, when I went to Denver, it was interesting because it was a very, you know, there was a cloud because it was not too far after the election. And I think every person left there feeling inspired, feeling as though they had joined a very important group of people that are going to be soldiers in the fight to mitigate climate change, and that we are part of, you know, the race against time. So he does that magic of giving us hope and also really almost imploring that we not make it a political conversation and that we all do everything we can to find the common ground. It never used to be a politically divisive conversation, and that we should all be doing the most that we can to bring people with common values to the table. And that's been a really good message for me to hold because I'm so radical. It's really,
I feel though that our real work is to make sure that this film doesn't just preach to the choir. You know,
all of us who have
the feeling that this has to happen, we have to change, we've got to do it quicker. The people that need to see this film and who we want to reach are in communities like Georgetown, Texas, where, you know, there is a conservative Republican base. They may not believe entirely in climate change, but they can at least see a crack of reason in the financial implications of alternative energy. You know, we have to go into communities that voted for Donald Trump, frankly, and figure out how to bring them on board, whatever means necessary. And so the campaign around this film is going to become incredibly important in terms of figuring out, and there's a machine behind this campaign that's already revving up, that's going to figure out how to get into those communities and hit them hard and bring them on board. You know, we have a problem in this country of disenfranchised people. We know this from the outcome of our election, who feel that they're not being heard. And we need to figure out how to hear them.
I am so, so, so happy that you brought that up. And it's a great message again. Our group, the Climate Reality Group here, is constantly saying that. We're going to have the theater in a place in South Tucson and have faith-based leaders and people that are not traditionally the ones you see at every climate march and women's march.
Exactly.
And trying to expand that. Okay, everybody, we'll be right back. Short break. I know that you're on the edge of your seats like I am. John Schenck and Bonnie Cohen about an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power. We'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being a part of it. Please join me once again in welcoming John Schenck and Bonnie Cohen, award-winning directors of the soon-to-be-released film An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. A decade after An Inconvenient Truth, the 2006 Academy Award winner for Best Documentary brought climate change into the heart of popular culture, and now comes this follow-up that shows just how close we are to a real energy revolution. And again, a little bit more about John and Bonnie. They have produced and directed critically acclaimed award-winning documentaries. These films have been shot in dozens of countries around the world and range in subject matter from first to historical examinations to international politics. And I encourage and invite all of our listeners to what is wrong with me? I'm trying to get through this too fast. Slow down, Gina, to visit actualfilms.net to learn more about their important work. And once again, thank you both for being with us. So,
thanks for having us.
It just amazes me how the time flies. So let's not waste my time, anybody's time saying that. So can we switch to a minute and talk about the relevance of the movie to what I call real life, real measurable science and observations that I think almost any thinking human being can make. And just a brief recap of the past 3 years, not 10, in terms of where we are doing as a planet, and just bear with me. Our planet has set new heat records. Oceans are heating up. The Antarctica and Greenland ice shelves are melting, threatening Earth with destructive sea level rise. The Arctic is warming up at unprecedented levels. We're seeing real specific consequences of our warming planet. Communities around the world, including those in the U.S., like Miami, are having to relocate because of rising sea levels, foreshadowing a likely future in which millions of climate refugees will need to find a new home. The five-year drought in California led to water rationing in the state, and more powerful storms fueled by warming oceans are battering the coasts of countries like the Philippines. So as directors of documentaries that are intentionally meant to be dramatic, why would you make one if you didn't have a powerful dramatic message? Was the reality just the reality of seeing what is happening dramatic enough for both of you? Or were there even surprises that you felt compelled to include in the film?
Unfortunately, the reality is more than dramatic. We went into this project knowing a fair amount about climate change, but of course we were also surprised. Al Gore runs something of a clearinghouse for climate-related news and science, and he really has this incredible team that just keeps him and his whole staff updated on the latest environmental state of the world. We visited Greenland with Al early on in the process, and it was really an amazing thing. To go to Greenland is really a humbling experience. It really is kind of one of the wonders of the world. Just so beautiful, painfully beautiful. Looking at the ice sheets and the icebergs that calve off and float out to sea, but you have this kind of simultaneous feeling when you go there, which is one of those wonder of the world, Grand Canyon, kind of moments where you're just looking at the awe of nature. But very immediately, almost in the same second, you realize that it has a disease, that it's melting, that there's cracks in it, that there's rivers flowing through it that shouldn't be, that it's kind of falling apart. And the reason is that global warming actually happens faster at the poles. So the Antarctica and the Arctic are actually warming faster than the areas that human populations roam around on. And they're kind of a foretelling of what's going to happen. And so it was really an emotional trip for us, but more importantly for Al, and because he spent his whole life on this. And we felt like we had to capture that for the film. And that's early in the film, and it kind of reminds the audience that about the importance of the quest, which is to try to do something about slowing this down and stopping it.
And
we had a 15-year-old kid come up to us. We were just at the Nantucket Film Festival, and he came up to us, and he's trying to do good work in the climate space. He's starting a blog for kids his age, and it's actually really, he's done the climate reality training. And he said, I live in a suburb in Colorado, suburb of Denver, south of Denver, and, very conservative. And, what do I tell people who just don't believe the science and come back at me and just say, this isn't happening because of man-made global warming. It's just happening to the planet. What kinds of arguments can I put forward? And, so we talked to him about the Christian argument, which is, the safekeeping of our planet and human beings need a safe planet to live on, and that's sort of written in the Bible kind of thing. You could go with that. You can, continuously show images of fossil fuel companies that are pumping pollution into the atmosphere, et cetera. But the truth is that until you go and you see, as John said, the kind of virus and the cracks and the ice that are just totally unnatural in a place like that, like Greenland, it is hard to convince people that just don't believe, and that is our uphill battle. You know, we who know what's going on can work fast and get on the alternative energy train. It's convincing those who don't believe, and you know, and just how do you do that? So we're hoping that the visual, the imagery of this film, which is so emotional, can get at the heart of those that are having trouble believing in global warming.
And it's so meaningful to me that you shared that story, because the Mrs. Green's World Journey, I mean, I had a 35-year career in mental health services, you know, managing large volume mental health contracts around the country. And I went to the Amazon. I went to Peru. And what I saw changed my life, obviously, because I came back and started Mrs. Green's World, and people thought I had come undone and that I had really had a lot of fun with ayahuasca in the jungle. And it's like, what are you doing? What do you mean you're starting a radio show on sustainability? But that was the feeling, Bonnie, when I saw the devastation of the rainforest, and not just about the trees being cut and burned, not even taken for their wood, and then saw the rains come and the erosion and families sitting on just sterile soil with no trees. And it is transformative. And trying to bring that back to the United States has been my mission ever since. But anyway.
Yeah, what, no, really, that's great. And it's really, really important to see, to go out and see the world in whatever way you can.
Right.
And come back. And
and of course, that's the beauty of documentaries. You can sit in a theater and
yes,
have that work done for you in a way. And we really took that seriously, that the places that we were going in the world, we really wanted to bring back in a meaningful way.
Yes. And I'm sure just from the clips that we saw at the Climate Reality Project, I'm so excited. My passion will be reignited if that's even necessary. So let's talk for a minute about, segue into some of the myths that I find annoying, but I have to address them with love and patience, that going green is so expensive, when the real truth in many cases is that it continues to boost the economy. And I know Al Gore addressed it in the training. Does the movie address anything about jobs in the solar industry that really last, jobs in the wind industry that are one of the fastest growing segments of the labor market? Did you take that on in the sequel?
Yeah, there's a whole section of the film about renewable, what Al calls the sustainable energy revolution. You know, it's interesting. Bonnie said this earlier, climate policy really should not be a political argument. It has become kind of a tribal argument in our country because of the kind of so-called blue-red, you know, kind of dynamic that's taken hold over the last 10, 15 years with presidential elections especially. But really, at its core, it's mostly, if you look at it through the economic lens, that's really, really starts to make a lot of sense. You know, I take just a minute to remind people that there was one really great UN, United Nations success story regarding climate around the ozone layer in the 80s, and very quickly, within a few years of scientists telling us that there was this kind of growing hole in the ozone layer due to refrigerant chemicals, there was an international treaty to ban them, get rid of them, and essentially, to a large extent, that's been healed. And when global warming first was kind of brought to our attention in the 80s and early 90s, there was kind of a similar feeling internationally, like, okay, well, the world's going to have to get together and do something about this. But the problem is that, and this gets to back to the kind of economic piece, is that some very powerful companies at that point saw a huge threat because, in order to solve the problem, and the oil companies knew at the time, because they were doing their own science, that we would have to stop putting so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And that really created this money game, helped create this money lobbying game in politics, which has, you know, gotten worse even to this day. And so the good news about that is that there is a lot of money to be made in solar and wind, and the financiers of the world have woken up to this in a big way. And we've had incredible screenings, actually, of the film for bankers all around the world, finance people, money people, who know that the assets, the carbon assets on the books of these giant oil companies are not burnable, because they're, if we keep burning them, the world won't sustain an economy that can allow them to be burned.
Right.
And so it's a lot of kind of gobbledygook. I hate to bore listeners, but it really is a powerful message, which is that we are at the cusp of not only creating jobs, which it is one of the fastest growing industries in our country in terms of jobs, but really totally changing the way our world economic engine functions. And it's going to happen probably faster than we think it will.
And that's not gobbledygook, John. It's really important information for us to absorb. And I love the tagline for my show, "We don't tell you what to think, we just want you to." We have to think about that. It's really, that's the story, that's the message. So don't be afraid of some deep thinking, which brings me to the next question. What about the message of change? Does the movie lead us to either intuitive or very direct calls to action, showing how change is possible, not just through international collaborations, but on the individual and local levels? Do you have some examples of what we might be engaged to do once we leave the movie? Because I see that as a beginning. And Bonnie, I'm going to take what you said very seriously about bringing, I'm not sure I know anyone who's a climate denier, and I'm not just saying that because we fill our circles with people of like minds, but reaching out to some people that might be skeptics. So are there going to be calls to actions in it, or are you hoping for a change in individual behavior? What are your visions for how this will impact us on a ripple effect?
I mean, it's a very big question. And
it really is. It might not even be fair to ask it.
No. I mean, the short answer is yes, there's going to be a very robust campaign around this film. There are specific calls to action at the end of the film, and that also have links and very specific activities on the website and convenientsequel.com. And, you know, what we are asking in the film, what participants and Paramount and Al Gore and all of us would like the film to do, is to make sure that the American people and people around the world realize that they are empowered to move this alternative energy revolution faster. That if our leaders are going to be obstructionists, such as, you know, Trump pulling out of the climate Paris Accord, we are going to be the ones to move this forward. And that's already happening, as we said earlier, on the local and state levels in this country and around the world. I mean, we get such inspiration from the people that go to the climate reality trainings, to mayors like the Mayor Dale Ross in Georgetown, Texas.
Right.
To, you know, the city of Pittsburgh, Aspen, Colorado, entire states like California and New York, Massachusetts, that have taken up their own climate action to do the work of the Paris Climate Accord. We can do this as a country and international citizens around the world. Can every day chip away at using your own, the choices that you make, whether it's consumer choices or otherwise, the votes, who you vote for, and how you work on your local representation and government to do the right thing vis-a-vis the climate crisis, and to use your voice, take to the streets. This is a moment, a calling for all of us. You know, when leaders behave the way that our leader has in the face of the climate crisis, it is time to take to the streets, and people are already doing it, and they're going to continue to. And if you can convince one person a day or a month or every 6 months that the climate crisis is real, but that we have real solutions to it, then you're part of this work. And it's very inspiring. I think that it's something that kids, teenagers, and young people can really relate to. And this is their issue, right? This is their, you know, when we were growing up, it was nuclear weapons and, you know, we were all involved in anti-nukes. The climate crisis is the issue of the time for young people. And I think we have an opportunity here to seize on that and get folks out doing the right thing.
And what a, you know, we have about 3 minutes left, and I don't think we have time for this last question, but I always do it anyway. I heard Catherine Cahoe, a very well-respected climate scientist, speak at the University of Arizona recently. And one of the points she made is she refuses to debate with climate deniers, climate scientists who are deniers, because she said there's only 97% of scientists don't even debate it. So why should be on any national platform to debate it? Because it's not a debatable issue, and I don't want to give any credence to it. What's your response to that? Should we be ignoring the climate deniers? That's kind of where I tend to go.
I think she has a point in the sense that, quote-unquote, climate deniers, what's often behind that, if you kind of peel the onion back, is, again, kind of this, what Al Gore calls our kind of hacked political system, which has been hacked by money from fossil fuel companies who have a lot of economic benefit from kind of keeping business as usual going. So it is true that there really isn't a debate among 97% of scientists in the world. So, but on the other hand, a lot of people have fallen under the spell of this false message. And so it is true that we have to reach out with kind of human kindness, as
yes.
you said, to understand where that's coming from. And we've actually met some conservatives who flipped on climate because they've realized that they were being fed false information. And that's very powerful. You know, there's now, I think, 30 Republican Congress people who've changed their position to be on the right side of climate issues, including Daryl Issa from Southern California, from Orange County, one of the most conservative counties in the country.
And what a message of hope on which to end. And I told you the time would fly. Everybody, the call to action, see the movie, bring a friend, bring someone who's on the fence. It premieres July 28th in select theaters and on August 4th all over the country. Be the change. John and Bonnie, I could not thank you enough. This was everything I hoped it would be and more. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.